Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take your burning questions and, the resources you send us, and we try to pull out the core knowledge you need fast.
Yeah, think of it as us doing the heavy lifting, so you get the key insights without getting totally swamped.
Exactly. And today, we're tackling a really interesting piece one of you shared. It's a formal methodological framework. Sounds technical, I know.
It does, but it's about something fascinating. Legal pluralism and intercultural justice. Specifically in Mexico. The source is from April 2025.
Right. Legal pluralism. Let's start there. What does that actually mean on the ground?
Well, basically, it's acknowledging that within one country, like Mexico, the official state law isn't the only system operating. You often have community-based legal systems, too.
Working alongside the state system.
Yeah, often with their own rules, their own ways of handling things, disputes, agreements, that sort of thing.
Okay. So the mission for us today is to unpack this framework someone sent in. Understand how it helps analyze these interactions.
Exactly. How do these different systems talk to each other? Or don't talk? How do human rights fit in? Gender equality.
And how does one system maybe recognize another? All those tricky questions, right?
Precisely. This framework aims to give us a structured way to look at all that, to move beyond just saying, yeah, there are multiple systems, and really dig into the mechanics.
Okay, so let's dive in. The document, it kicks off by pointing out some problems with, let's say, simpler ways of looking at this. It mentions rejecting deterministic assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that rejection important? What's the insight there?
Well, the key insight is that you can't just assume a community's legal practices are a simple, predictable result of their, say, economic situation or social structure.
Ah, okay. So you can't just look at the conditions and say, therefore, their laws must be X.
Exactly. It pushes back on that. It suggests things are more complex. Practices might have their own history, their own internal logic. It's not just a reaction to external factors.
Got it. And it also challenges something called epistemic monism. That sounds academic.
It does sound a bit jargony, yeah. But the practical point is really important.
Okay.
It questions the idea that only the state, like Mexico's Supreme Court, for example, has the legitimate authority to say what the law is.
So challenging the state's monopoly on legal truth, kind of.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
By challenging epistemic mongerism, the framework opens up space to say, hey, maybe community assemblies, maybe even international bodies, can also be valid sources of legal understanding and norms.
Right. So it's not just the state's perspective that matter.
Exactly. It allows for recognizing legitimacy elsewhere, which is, a pretty big shift from a purely state-centric view.
Okay. And the framework also talks about avoiding circular inferences. How does it try to stop us from basically arguing in circles when we talk about legal recognition?
Right. The classic circular argument, assuming what you're trying to prove.
Yeah.
So the framework tries to avoid this by using formal logic. It says legal recognition can't just be based on saying this community has this law, so it should be recognized.
It needs more than that.
It needs to depend on something verifiable, something you can actually demonstrate. Like how well can the state and community systems actually work together? They call that institutional interoperability.
Ah, so recognition needs an independent justification based on practical stuff, not just self-assertion.
Precisely. It can't just be self-justifying. There have to be external, observable reasons.
Makes sense. Okay, let's shift gears to the interdisciplinary toolkit this framework uses. First up, fuzzy logic. Sounds like something from engineering, maybe.
Huh. Yeah, it does have roots elsewhere. But the insight here is actually pretty useful for law and society.
How so?
Well, think about evaluating if a community practice aligns with human rights. It's rarely a simple yes or no, is it?
True. It's usually shades of gray.
Exactly. Fuzzy logic lets you measure the degree of compatibility. It uses these things called membership functions, often based on standards like CEDAW, the Women's Rights Convention.
So instead of a binary, it gives you a score. Like, how compatible is it on a scale?
Kind of, yeah. It acknowledges the messy reality. It lets you see where the tensions are, how significant they are, rather than just making a blunt judgment. It's more nuanced.
Okay, I can see how that would be useful. Then there are nonlinear inferential networks, represented as graphs. Sounds even more technical.
Yeah, let's break it down. Imagine a web or a map.
Okay.
Each important element, like the community's justice system, human rights standards, the political environment, maybe it's a point, a node on this map.
Right.
And the lines connecting them, the edges, show how these things influence each other.
So how one factor affects another.
Exactly. And nonlinear just means the influence isn't always a simple direct cause and effect. Lots of things can interact in complex ways. It helps visualize all the interconnected pieces.
So it's a way to map out the whole ecosystem, see how the parts relate, rather than looking at each bit in isolation.
That's a good way to put it. It shows the dynamic relationships.
How does this approach connect with, say, international standards on intercultural dialogue?
Well, it aligns quite well. It emphasizes needing neutral ground, neutral institutional frameworks for dialogue, where human rights are respected by everyone involved.
So, facilitating conversation without one side dominating.
Right. But it's also careful not to fall into pure cultural relativism.
That's always the tricky part, isn't it? Respecting difference versus upholding universal values. How does it balance that?
It sets minimum thresholds. It says, look, we respect diversity, but there are fundamental human rights baselines. Practices that fall below these or are just fundamentally incompatible. They can't be accepted.
So there's a line in the sand.
Pretty much. It tries to find that balance. Respect diversity, but uphold core rights.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's look at the underlying principles, the epistemological principles guiding this whole thing. First, it says legal pluralism isn't just a fact, it's a normative hypothesis. What's the difference? Why does that matter?
It matters because it shifts the perspective. Saying it's just a fact is like saying, yep, multiple legal systems exist.
Okay. It's observing reality.
Right. But calling it a normative hypothesis suggests it's something we should maybe aim for. An ethical commitment, almost.
Yeah.
A structural goal to ensure collective rights are recognized, that diverse ways of organizing life are valued.
So it's not just descriptive, it's prescriptive. It's saying this is maybe a better way.
In a way, yes. It frames legal pluralism as a positive value, something to work towards for a more just society, rather than just a phenomenon to be managed.
Interesting. Okay, second principle. Community justice doesn't automatically equal human rights protection. Seems kind of obvious, but how does the framework suggest we check this?
Yeah, it seems obvious, but it's crucial. The framework insists on active verification. You can't just assume.
How do you verify it?
That's where tools like the fuzzy logic come back in. You use established standards, CA, the Mexican Constitution are mentioned, to actively assess how well community practices actually align with human rights, with gender equality.
Mm.
It has to be demonstrated.
Got it. Must be checked, not assumed. And third, intercultural dialogue isn't automatic either. What does it say makes dialogue more likely?
It points to several things. Political factors matter, obviously, but also what it calls epistemic factors, like legal translatability. Can concepts from one system even be understood in the other?
Like translating ideas, not just words.
Exactly. And also, crucially, the genuine willingness of everyone involved to actually engage in dialogue. It talks about horizontality meeting as equals, not one system dictating to the other.
So willingness and the ability to actually understand each other are key.
Definitely. Without those, dialogue is unlikely to be meaningful.
And the last principle here, legal recognition isn't just up to the state, like the Supreme Court. Who else gets a say?
This is important, too. The framework broadens the picture. It says recognition processes within communities themselves matter. And international bodies can also play a role in validating or recognizing community legal systems.
So recognition can come from multiple places.
Yes. It reflects the idea of shared competence in diverse states.
Mm.
Authority isn't solely concentrated at the top.
Okay. Let's dig into those conditions for dialogue and recognition a bit more. For dialogue to happen, the framework lists a bunch of influencing factors. What are some key ones?
Well, things like the community's past experiences, positive or negative, with the state system. That obviously shapes attitudes.
Makes sense.
Also, their ability to organize and make legal claims, legal mobilization.
Mm.
How tolerant or open state institutions are.
Uh-huh.
That willingness to dialogue we just mentioned from all sides. Crucially, the absence of threats or repressions. People need to feel safe to talk.
Right.
And that epistemic translatability. Again, the capacity to bridge the understanding gap.
It sounds like a lot needs to line up. The framework warns against just adding these factors up, though. Why?
Because they interact. You know, some might be absolute must-haves. Others might just help things along or block things. Simply summing them up misses the complex interplay. You need to see how they connect and influence each other.
Okay, so it's about the relationships between the factors. What about the conditions for actual legal recognition? What needs to be in place?
For recognition, the framework highlights a few things. First, you need a validating actor, someone or something with the perceived authority to grant recognition.
Like the state court, an international body, or maybe even the community's own assembly?
Exactly. Any of those could potentially function as a validating actor. Second, cultural validation. Does the practice align with the community's own core values?
Internal legitimacy.
Yes. And third, that institutional interoperability. Again, a practical level of ability for the systems to coexist and interact without constant breakdown or conflict needs to be above a certain threshold.
And meeting these conditions determines the probability of recognition.
That's the idea. The probability goes up based on how strong the cultural validation is, how good the interoperability is, how open the state is generally, and whether there are good mechanisms for mediation between the systems. It's a mix of factors.
Right. Now, how does a specific community practice even get considered for inclusion in this whole intercultural justice picture? What are the initial requirements?
Okay, so the framework lays out five criteria for a practice to be considered a candidate, like an initial screening test.
What are they?
One, is there actually a community justice system operating? GSTUNT-BC. Two, is it compatible to a sufficient degree with human rights and gender equity?
Two down.
Three. Does the community show a predisposition to dialogue? I am Taylor Sundar QC. Four. Is there enough institutional interoperability in Truths and Keys? And five. Are any fundamental incompatibilities below an acceptable level? Syncomp.
So pass those five and you're a candidate.
Exactly. It means the practice has the basic building blocks. But crucially, it doesn't guarantee it's fully included or recognized.
Right. So what happens next? What determines if a candidate practice actually makes it into the set of recognized intercultural justice practices?
That's where the second stage comes in. Final inclusion is seen as probabilistic. It depends on other, often broader factors.
Like what?
Things like, are there effective mediation mechanisms in place? MEDIAS. How open is the state, really, to legal pluralism, AE? Are there wider structural reforms happening to support it? Istino. And what's the general societal understanding, the epistemic context?
See it.
So even if a practice meets all the initial criteria, the bigger picture, the political climate, institutional support really matters for final acceptance.
Absolutely. It shows that legal inclusion isn't just a technical exercise. It's deeply political and social.
The document apparently has a diagram, an inferential network showing this. Can you walk us through the two main stages it depicts?
Sure. Think of it flowing left to right. Phase one is that candidacy evaluation.
Checking the five criteria.
Right. The inputs are, does community justice exist? Is it compatible with human rights? Is there willingness to dialogue? Enough interoperability? And acceptable incompatibility. If yes to all, you get to the Practica Candidata node, the candidate practice.
Okay, makes sense. Then phase two.
Phase two is the probabilistic inclusion evaluation. The candidate practice node feeds into this. And the likelihood of inclusion is then influenced by those other factors. Mediation, MEIS, state openness, AE, structural reforms, RE, and the epistemic context, CE.
And these determine the final probability of inclusion.
Yes. They feed into the final outcome node, representing the likelihood of the practice being included in the set of recognized intercultural justice practices, PPIJ.
The diagram also shows some auxiliary relationships, secondary influences.
Yeah, little side arrows, basically. Like, having a community justice system might make willingness to dialogue more likely, though it's not guaranteed.
Okay.
The general epistemic context can influence how human rights are judged or how interoperability is perceived. And things like mediation and state openness can directly boost the potential for interoperability.
So it's really showing a complex system with lots of feedback loops and interconnected parts.
Exactly. It underlines that inclusion is a process, often gradual, shaped by many interacting elements, useful for thinking through policy impacts or even simulations, potentially.
How does the framework argue for its own validity? How do we know it's a sound way to analyze things?
Good question. Points to a few things. First, logical formal coherence. It's designed to be internally consistent, avoid contradictions. You can't get included without meeting the candidacy criteria, for example.
Logical consistency.
Right. And trying to keep the different factors relatively independent in the model, conceptually at least. Second, situational correspondence.
Meaning it fits reality.
Sort of. It means it can be adapted.
Hmm.
Those fuzzy logic membership functions, for instance, can be calibrated based on real-world data from specific cases. So it's not rigid. It can be tailored.
Okay. And third?
Epistemic openness. This relates back to avoiding epistemic monism. The framework allows the wider context, the societal understanding, to directly influence how practices are evaluated. It avoids imposing just one single viewpoint, like solely the state's legal view.
So it tries to be logical, adaptable, and open to different perspectives.
That's the goal, yes.
Okay, so assuming it's a valid approach, what are some concrete, practical ways this could be used?
Well, one obvious area is analyzing those tricky conflicts of jurisdiction between state and community systems.
How would it help there?
By using the framework's elements, like assessing the community practice, JC, the level of interoperability, interop, the points of incompatibility, syncomp, you could potentially pinpoint why there's conflict and assess if coordination is feasible.
Identifying the sticking points.
Exactly. Another application is designing better intercultural protocols for people in the justice system, prosecutors, defenders, judges.
How so?
By focusing on things like mediation, me, and the epistemic context, CE, you could build protocols that ensure due process in diverse settings. Maybe incorporating anthropological experts,
right,
ensuring language access, avoiding just imposing one set of cultural assumptions.
Making the system itself more interculturally competent.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It also mentions use as a simulation tool.
Right. You mentioned that. How would that work?
You could tweak the variables in the model, say, hypothetically increase state openness, AE,
right,
or introduce certain reforms, RE, and see how that changes the simulated probability of recognition for certain practices.
So like a policy sandbox, testing potential impacts.
Yeah, for risk analysis or assessing reform impacts before implementing them could be quite powerful.
And finally, informing public policy design.
Definitely. It provides a structured way to move beyond just state-centric policies. You could design policies that allow for different levels of recognition based on meeting different criteria in the framework.
Tiered recognition, maybe.
Possibly. And you could develop indicators based on the framework's elements to track progress towards a more genuinely pluralistic system.
Wow. Okay. So it seems like this framework, while complex, offers a really robust and adaptable way to get a handle on legal pluralism.
I think so. It certainly pushes beyond simplistic views and demands a more systematic, nuanced approach.
And it really hammers home that need for verifiable conditions for recognition while constantly checking against fundamental human rights and gender equality. That balance seems key.
It is. Respecting diversity doesn't mean abandoning core principles. The framework tries to show a path for doing both.
Yeah, finding that balance. And it suggests that building a truly just pluralistic system really relies on fostering dialogue, making different systems work together practically.
Institutional interoperability, yeah.
And cultivating that openness to different ways of seeing justice.
Exactly. It lays out a kind of roadmap for thinking about how to achieve that.
Well, it certainly gives us a lot to think about. So here's a final thought for you, our listener. If we take this kind of detailed, multifaceted approach seriously, how might it change how we view justice and recognition, not just in Mexico, but maybe in any diverse society dealing with different ways people organize their lives? Something to chew on. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.